Welcome back, everyone. Podchat Live episode 120. Recording here with Craig, as always, on the 2nd of April, 2024. Some of you may not know, the 1st of April is a special day for both Craig and myself, sort of individually. It's Craig's birthday, and it's also my wedding anniversary. We share this special day, and also as so people who are not fans of pseudoscience and are big fans of critical thinking, it's also April Fool's Day. So it's always made me smile how we've shared that day, Craig. Did you have a nice birthday?
I did. We actually went to the Louvre, which is featuring a Leonardo da Vinci exhibition, which is really incredible. And if you want to have a look at a couple of pictures, I put them on Facebook.
Lovely. Perfect. Great. So we have a fair bit to get through. We've got a few messages we've received, a few news articles, and then a few research papers as well. So without further ado, let's press on, and let's first give a shout out to Michelle Jones. Michelle is a podiatrist at the Washbourne House Therapy Centre, which is in Swindon in the UK. She posted a lovely photo on social media last week on Wednesday morning. Which is obviously when a lot of people listen to us, because by the time we post this up, it's late Tuesday evening in the UK. So a lot of people use it for their commute to work on Wednesday. And she was on her Wednesday morning walk while listening to us, and she posted that she said it was lovely to hear that new graduates were finding it kept them connected to the profession. And that was off the back of what Emily had said the week before. She said, "I'm at the other end of the spectrum with 25 years experience, and I could easily become out of touch. Thank you for keeping our feet on the ground," lovely pun there, "with the latest research." So thank you for that, Michelle. Really appreciate it. Love the fact that 25 years in, that we've still got that kind of that hunger to kind of stay in touch and listen to research. Back at the sort of earlier career end of the spectrum, also saw a message on Facebook from Hannah Krepsky, who is a second year podiatry student. I didn't quite catch where she was studying, but she has started listening just a few weeks ago on her commute, and she said the podcast is highly informative and she's really enjoying listening. So thank you, Hannah. Please do share it with your colleagues, your peers in your student group. And also, if you've only started a few weeks ago, you've got a bit of a back catalogue to work through. So hopefully you'll continue to listen. Keep those messages coming in. We love them. Message us on social media or send us an email. Get involved at podchatlive.com. On the social media front, you may remember a few weeks ago, friend of the show, James Welsh, took a photo of himself sitting in, I think he was in a hot tub or a pool somewhere, at his brother's wedding, was he in Cuba, I think, from memory? And sort of inspired a little sort of shout out for seeing if anyone could top it. I've come up with a bit of a catchy name as well, Podsnap Live. So hashtag PodSnapLive. This is you taking a photo. Doesn't have to be of yourself, but it can be of you, your phone with the podcast on it, with something amazing, beautiful in the background. Just put up a photo of someone who sent us one yesterday. We've put it on our Instagram stories and also on our X or Twitter feed. They are in Mexico with the Pyramid of the Moon in the background, and it is an incredible photo. I'd love to see if anyone can beat that. I'd love to keep those. We're sort of a, heading into, I guess, holiday season soon. So looking forward to getting a bit of a flurry of these. So hashtag PodSnapLive. Again, just email them to us or tag us on social media so that we can find them and that we can share them and give you a shout out if you wish. Okay, in the news, a couple of articles here. First one, you may remember back before Christmas, 5th of December, to be precise, in episode 104, one of the topics we discussed was foot surgery turf wars, and this was off the back of the 60-minute program on podiatric surgery in Australia, where essentially a bit of a hit piece by orthopedics was the general vibe at the time. Sort of off the back of that, but not quite. There was a news story that broke in the last week. And the first thing I knew about it was Craig sent me a link, and the title was APRA to axe podiatric surgeon title. And I thought, wow, what's going on here? This feels a bit final. Now, I should preface this by saying I don't pretend to fully understand the ins and outs of this. Firstly, because I'm not Australia based. Secondly, I'm not a surgeon, obviously. And quite clearly, this is a very complex issue. But there's been a recent independent review that was completed by a medical law expert. It's important to note that this launched back in October. So this predated this television program. So although it's on the same topic, it's not because of the television program per se. But it was essentially a result of overrepresentation of complaints about podiatric surgeons in Australia. So despite there being only, I believe, approximately 40 of them in Australia, a significant overrepresentation of complaints about them. Now, this independent review was published last week. It was 59 pages long. And I won't pretend to have completely digested it, but we'll get Craig's kind of thoughts in a minute. But the interesting thing was what started off as a sort of, I guess, a bit of a tabloid title that the term podiatric surgeon was going to be axed. Clearly got more nuanced and complicated than that, because it was essentially a review which made 14 recommendations over six key areas. And one of those areas was the title. But there were five other areas as well: registration and practice, education and training, advertising, handling of complaints, system safety and quality. APRA and the Podiatry Board of Australia have then announced that they've accepted the report's 14 recommendations. But I think the next stage of the process, if I understand it correctly, is that they're going to hold a consultation before committing to any changes. And I think it's important to note two things. That ultimately the podiatry board can make recommendations, but the decision, the final decision, is up to and is made by the ministers. And that ultimately all of this has the patient safety at the front and center of its aims and objectives. I hope to anyone listening who's better informed than me, which will be many people, I haven't misrepresented anything there. And I've been factual and neutral in my sort of reporting of that news article in the last week. Craig, do you have anything to add?
No, that was a very good summary of it. That title of the article that I sent you was from a medical website, which is why I sent it to you. But I again, it's all about patient safety. If you read through the recommendations, most of them are pretty reasonable. I don't have any issues with. I know it is a very, say, sensitive issue about the title. And again, the minister will have to make a decision based on the board's recommendation and all the lobbying that's likely to go on.
Yeah, I'm certain this won't be the last time we talk about it, because things are clearly going to progress and evolve. So we'll again, we'll just mention it as things progress. One more thing that I saw in the mainstream news last week, and we are a bit close to my home here in the UK. This is in the lovely Wales, and this was a podiatrist based in Powys. Goodness, I hope I've said that correctly. Powys-based podiatrist who stored hundreds of medical records at his home. A combination of this being considered to be inappropriate, but also that actually he did not complete adequate case records, resulted in him being removed from the HCPC register after a tribunal investigated him. So over 300 patient records were found in his home. So I think this speaks to, I guess, the importance of understanding the do's and don'ts, the legislation, the appropriateness around appropriate note keeping, not just what we write in their notes and how good they are, but actually, note storage. Craig, you had an interesting thought when you first saw this about what it may mean for people that still do paper notes, or people that don't have kind of, computer-based notes, particularly people who are not clinic-based.
Yeah, no, well, that's as soon as you sent me the link to it, my immediate reaction was, what about those who are totally home-based or home-visiting-based podiatrists who do not use cloud or computer-based records? They have to store their patient records somewhere. The only option they have is at home. Now, I assume laws and regulations are slightly different between the UK and Australia, but records have to be stored securely. Whether a locked filing cabinet is at home is considered sufficient or not, I don't know. I don't know the actual, I've read the news article on this particular case, But it is of concern. I'm sure you and I in the past, before we started using computer and cloud-based systems, are guilty of taking records home to complete notes and write letters after hours. They have to be secured, stored securely. And I'm, again, without having read the details of this, I'm not sure what the HCPC considers stored securely to mean.
Yep. No, same. And we're not fishing here for, sponsorship from one of the many computer-based note systems, of course, but it does feel like that may be a good way to protect yourself from these kind of things. But anyway, let's press on with the published research in that's caught our eye in the last week. So three of these to get through. First one. This wasn't actually published in the last week. I think we must have missed it. It was actually published on the 5th of February. So we're about, well, for us, that's quite, we're quite late on this. Although it's only sort of 5 weeks ago, something like that, that's quite late for us. We must have missed it. It was in the European Journal of Sports Science, and it was led by a team of researchers from New York City in the US. And it was a systematic review, and this was its title: Throwing Cold Water on Muscle Growth. A systematic review with meta-analysis of the effects of post-exercise cold water immersion on resistance training-induced hypertrophy. Now, I came across this on Steve Magnus's Twitter feed, actually. I love his Twitter feed. I think he's just such a great thinker, such a great sort of scientist. And he was of the same opinion in that, you won't have missed the fact that in recent weeks, months, or maybe even years, particularly across social media, ice bathing and cold water immersion and, polar plunges, whatever you want to call them, the Wim Hof method, they get kind of trendy, don't they? And all of the influencers start doing them, and all of the online PTs start doing them. And
Oh,
before
and
we know
all
it,
the celebrity, all the celebrities are doing it,
yeah,
you
absolutely. Everyone's jumping on the bandwagon, and no one really asks the question, is this helpful? So this was a systematic review that looked at the effects of post-exercise cold water immersion. So basically, after you've been in the gym and you've lifted some iron, jumping in an ice bath, and it looked at the effects of this on resist coupled with resistance training on gains in measures of muscle growth. So this was more about kind of muscle growth, hypertrophy, and it looked at eight studies, and it became quite clear that taking an ice bath after strength training impairs your gains. Steve Magnus quite beautifully summarized that the inflammation, the damage, the stress that we cause our muscles when doing resistance training, is the signal for adaptation. So you take away the signal for adaptation and you blunt the response. Now, again, I believe I'm right in remembering that there's been similar things said about taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And there's actually the converse is sort of true in that there's some research that points to using heat to enhance adaptation. So perhaps after you've lifted heavy weights in the gym, rather than getting in your ice bath, you should go get into the hot tub or the sauna. If you do like ice baths for whatever reason, and there's other reasons to like them, of course, then a couple of recommendations: put space between your ice bath and your strength workout, or choose them when recovery, because we're not talking about ice baths for recovery here, that's a different debate, but choose them when recovery is a bigger priority to you than training adaptation. So this might be mid-competition, for example. So I think that was a kind of interesting study that perhaps conflicted with what people will be seeing when they scroll through their Instagram break.
Oh, exactly. I mean, again, it actually has practical implications as well, which is what's good about this review. But the whole concept of the cold water baths, and interestingly, the parallels between that and going back 20 years about having a hot sauna, that there's a reasonable amount of work being done on saunas and more recently the cold baths on the impacts of that on physiological parameters. But then when you look at the research on recovery and it's or increases in fitness or whatever, they're not there. So the physiological changes are happening. So, but this is one of those few, say, systematic reviews that have linked a physiological change to actually a practical outcome, which is what I like about it. It's that sort of it's quite a nuanced difference. But from what I just getting off topic slightly, the what I understand the greatest benefit of say having a cold water bath is not necessarily exercise or injury related. It's just related to the endorphins that get released and you feel good afterwards. I mean, and I think that's why people are doing it. They just seem to feel better afterwards, but the evidence doesn't necessarily support any, say, clinical benefits of doing so in any great way at the moment. So.
Yeah. Okay, on to the next paper. Okay, this is a paper that was published on the 6th of March. So again, a couple of weeks ago now, we must have missed it. It was published in Physical Therapy in Sport from a group of researchers in the US, and it's titled "Asymmetric Running is Associated with Pain During Outdoor Running in Individuals with Achilles Tendinopathy in the Return to Sport Phase." Now, I think it'll become clear why we've chosen to talk about this paper. Craig will, I know Craig enjoys this one. Let's quickly talk about what they did. They took 17 runners who were suffering or had suffered with Achilles tendinopathy, but they were in the return to sport phase of their rehab, so end stage rehab. They monitored their running over a 2 week period, and essentially looked at a few running metrics. They looked at their frequency, their duration, their intensity. But the really interesting thing here was they did not sort of give them any prescription. The research team did not tell them what to do. They didn't standardize it. They basically just told every single one of these 17 runners to go back to their typical running program. And during this 2 week period, these runners did what they wanted. They did this to observe these runners' running behaviors. So things like frequency, duration, intensity, they weren't prescribed. They just did what they wanted over this 2 week period. They monitored their symptoms via a Visa A outcome tool, which is fairly well validated for the Achilles. And they also collected some bilateral lower leg gait data with some shoe-mounted sensors. They used the Zwift Run Pod. So a couple of things to mention. The first, and I'm trying not to smile when I say this, because it's one of those lovely conclusions that's really, really obvious. Achilles tendon pain during running is associated with offloading patterns in the injured leg. What they found was when you have a sore Achilles, you run a bit differently to protect it. And I know Craig, I see Craig smiling over my video here because I think we mentioned this just a week or two ago, didn't we? When things are sore, we move differently, funnily enough.
Yeah, we limp.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. So when you have a sore Achilles and you return to running, you offload that sore side, which shouldn't surprise us, I guess. The number of running bouts, as they referred to them, interestingly, was not associated with changes in pain, the Visa A scores, over the 2 week period. So essentially, how much you ran in that 2 weeks did not seem to influence short-term symptom severity. Now, bear in mind, it is just 2 weeks. So we do not know what that means for 3 weeks, 4 weeks beyond. I suspect when we're on a return to run program, if we do too much too soon, I can't see that going well. And it's really interesting to note when they looked at what the runners did when they were let loose and told they can do what they want. On average, over this 2 week period, the participants ran for on average 7 days, so they were running at least half of the time during the observation period. There was an average of 3 consecutive days run by most runners. So they weren't having kind of on off days. And the average distance was around 18 kilometers. So I think by most people's standards, returning from a tendinopathic episode, that might be considered a wee bit too much. I guess it depends on the individual. But the interesting thing was, like we said, over a 2 week period, this did not affect their Visa A scores, their pain scores. But I don't know what these runners would look like at 4 weeks, at 5 weeks, at 6 weeks. Craig, talk to me about this research. What do we take from this, other than the fact that when we let runners do their own thing, they might make bad decisions, they might do too much too soon, and that when we've got a sore part, we limp to protect it. Did this need to be done?
Look, I mean, the questions, apart from it's limping, that it raises for me was that asymmetry present before the injury and that was part of the cause of the injury? Or does that asymmetry persist for too long a period of time that we need to consider that as part of the rehab? Are they overloading another set of tissues? But as you said, at 4 weeks, it could have been gone. So they're the questions I would ask. Look, again, I think we know when someone's in pain, they walk or run differently. So as to whether the research should or shouldn't be done, well, yeah, it's just told us what we assume would be the case and we know from other studies. But I think it's those bigger pictures of did that asymmetry exist beforehand? And if that asymmetry persists, do we need something about it further down the track? So I think they're the two sort of say key issues coming out of it for me,
Yeah,
yeah.
I got the impression reading the paper that this was a bit of data that was collected as part of a bigger project, and they kind of looked at it and thought, oh, we can get a little publication out of this. So
Yeah.
right, last paper to talk about, and we may even, I'm looking at my stopwatch here, thinking we might go, this episode might be a bit longer this week because we've had so much to talk about. But this was published just last week, 29th of March. So what's that, 4 days ago? It was published in JFAR, the Journal of Foot and Ankle Research, from a group of researchers in China. So it's open access. Acute effects of negative heel shoes on perceived pain and knee biomechanical characteristics of runners with patellofemoral pain. 16 runners, all male, all rear foot strikers, mean age of 20 years old, all of whom have patellofemoral pain. Gave them two different pairs of shoes. Both were custom made, so they weren't branded. One had a 5 millimeter drop, and one had a negative drop of 11 millimeters. So I'm sure most people know, but I know we've got a lot of undergrads listening now. So the drop is the differential, the height differential in the stack height between the rear foot and the forefoot. So if the amount of cushioning you have under your heel is 30 mil under the heel and 20 mil under the forefoot, you have a 10 mil drop. I often describe it to patients as think of it as the height of the heel you're wearing, but in millimeters. So a 5 mil drop shoe is 5 millimeters higher at the back under the heel than it is at the front. And a negative drop shoe is the opposite. So it is 11 millimeters lower at the back, i.e., under the heel. So not shoes that are massively commercially available, which is why they were custom made. Now, they looked at things such as pain scales, visual analog scales. They looked at some biomechanical variables, kinematics, so visual measurable angular changes, and also kinetics, so joint moments and tissue stresses. And they looked at 20 meter long runway three times in each shoe and ran comparisons between the two. To summarize the findings, pain wise, bear in mind, these are people that had patellofemoral pain. They ran and they came back and they were asked to report their pain levels. No difference in visual analog scores between the two shoes. But when they looked at some of the biomechanical metrics, there were some significant differences in the negative heel shoes. So the following things were lower in the negative heel shoes: the foot inclination angle, so that means it had slightly changed their foot strike, peak patellofemoral joint stress during the stance phase, patellofemoral joint reaction force, knee extension moment, and quadricep force at the time of peak patellofemoral joint stress. All these things speak to possibly favorable biomechanical changes in people with patellofemoral pain when they are in a negative drop shoe. Yet no accompanying change in immediate pain scores, at least. Craig, thoughts?
Well, the reason I sent you this one is that as soon as I saw it, it reminded me of what I think was quite a significant keynote address at a major biomechanics conference, probably over 10 years ago now, by Peter Cavanagh. And he got quite critical of biomechanists who do all this incredible biomechanics research and reporting and measuring all these ch different changes that happen with interventions, but then don't follow their work through to do clinical trials. And he was very critical of that well over 10 years ago. And this study reminded me of that keynote address and that it was a good study. I have no issues with the study at all. We know some of, say, the biomechanical, alleged biomechanical risk factors for patellofemoral pain. This study showed that negative heel shoes can reduce some of those, the magnitude of some of those biomechanical parameters, but it didn't show any reduction in pain. Now, admittedly, it was only in one lab-based session that they asked what their VAS scores were. But that's what struck me was the fact that, well, yes, there was an improvement in the knee flexion angle, a decrease in patellofemoral contact area, but the pain didn't change. And that's something that I know I have been somewhat critical of over the last 10 years since hearing Peter Kavanaugh's keynote address. And I just thought this paper was quite timely to remind that you know, we can alter these biomechanical parameters with different sorts of foot orthotics, footwear interventions, gait retraining interventions, but that doesn't necessarily translate to a clinical trial showing the symptoms go down if you actually do that intervention. So that's what stood out for me. That was my take home from that study was, you know, good study, but it just altered biomechanical parameters and not pain.
Yeah, and even if it had shown, you know, really, really good sort of clinical applicability by changing pain as well, how feasible would it be for any of us to regularly recommend 11 millimeter negative heel drop shoes? They don't exist. They were custom made for this study. Now I know we could take someone from a high drop shoe and move them to a lower drop shoe, so we're not putting them into a negative heel. And I know that's this from memory is sort of in keeping with some of the literature, which says lower drop shoes can favorably modify patellofemoral joint forces as well. But we certainly can't find negative heel drop shoes on the market easily.
Well, no, it's not uncommon in, you know, these kinds of biomechanical, kinematic, kinetic studies to actually exaggerate the intervention to more clearly demonstrate an effect. So they have exaggerated the intervention by going to quite a massive negative drop, demonstrated the effect. But that doesn't mean, as you said, a more subtle intervention, just going from a 10 mil to a 5 mil drop shoe clinically is not this, you know, may be worth it. It may be more subtle, but it's not unusual to see that. We could say, well, that is a criticism of these kinds of studies that they do exaggerate the intervention.
We should probably remind ourselves as well of the zero-sum game, in that if this is the dramatic reduction in some biomechanical variables at the knee, let's ask the question about where forces elsewhere in the body may well dramatically increase. So
Oh, but
are
they
we
have to.
potentially exactly right? We're robbing Peter to pay Paul, so let's always bear that in mind as well. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Okay, let's wrap up because we're over time. As always, Craig, pleasure talking through the last week's sort of points of interest with you. We encourage people to message us, as I've said at the start, but I'll repeat it again. Social media, our handle is Podchat Live on Instagram, on X. Ask us questions, make comments, tell us where you're listening to us, send us your hashtag PodSnapLive. Email address is getinvolved@podchatlive.com. And we will be back a week from today with episode 121. Craig, pleasure as always. I'll see you next week.
No. All right. Thank you. And we'll see everyone next week.